I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drumroll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
This episode is brought to you by Beyond Natural Pet Food. Beyond Pet Food helps me care for what matters, my pets and my world. They help me nourish my pets with high-quality natural ingredients, like wild-caught salmon and organic free-range chicken. Beyond also has responsible sourcing practices and a long-term partnership with the Nature Conservancy. Beyond Pet Food, your pet, your world. Learn more at beyondpetfood.com.
Hello, I'm Rob Beckett.
And I'm Josh Widdicombe.
Welcome to Parent in Hell, the show in which Josh and I discuss what it's really like to be a parent, which I would say can be a little tricky.
So, to make ourselves, and hopefully you, feel better about the trials and tribulations of modern-day parenting, each week we'll be chatting to a famous parent about how they're coping.
Or hopefully how they're not coping.
And we'll also be hearing from you, the listener, with your tips, advice and, of course, tales of parenting woe.
Because let's be honest, there are plenty of times when none of us know what we're doing. Hello, you're listening to Parenting Hell with...
Ethan, can you say Josh Widdicombe?
Josh Widdicombe.
And Rob Beckett?
Rob Beckett.
Also, Mummy has a baby in her tummy. What's the baby going to be called?
Rob Beckett.
There we go. That's Rob big news, Beckett. Isn't it? The baby's going to be called Rob Beckett.
Is that true?
Hi, Rob and Josh. Loving the podcast. Thanks for getting us through last year. I've attached a clip of our son Ethan reading out your names as part of the intro. It's the usual Rob Beckett and Josh something unpronounceable. I'm also sending it because our second child is due in 2 days. And Ethan has decided to name him, stroke her, Rob Beckett. Sorry, Josh, you didn't make the cut. Keep up the good work. David, Laura, Ethan, and the bump, Rob Beckett.
Okay, so they are calling it Rob Beckett, though. Like, Rob Beckett first name, then their surname.
Rob Beckett, are they?
They're not. That's just so he lied. Well, not a fan of that, actually. Quite disappointed in Ethan's dad. But that's a bit of fun, isn't it? That's weird that a child knows that our names now, because
it is weird, isn't it? Yeah,
been forced to say it by the parents, but it's, you know, they've appeared on a, you know, I was going to say an award-winning podcast. We've not won any awards, no.
We've been nominated. We are a podcast,
and there's not many of them. how are you, Josh? Still getting up at 4:30 a.m.?
No, sorted. He woke up at 9 this morning.
I'm going to suggest something. Is he still getting up at 4:30, but you don't really want to talk about it?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. We'll talk about other things.
I'm going to sort it, Rob.
I know you're going to sort it, but at the moment, it's still 4:30 a.m. Let me talk to you about things that are going wrong in my life to make you feel a bit better.
Have you seen the film Falling Down?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, you know how he feels like he's going to sort out society?
Yeah.
I feel like that. How my mental state is at the moment.
Okay, so Michael Douglas falling down. Yeah, that's your mental state. Okay, that's slightly worrying. I do feel like that I should call someone about that.
You can call me the police. 4:15 if you want. I'll be around for a chat.
Yeah, I'll send the police for a welfare check at about, 3:15 a.m.? They'll probably be out there just waiting for the kid to get up for the day. This is what my daughters get a little bit of iPad time or Kindle Fire time at the weekends, before bed and in the daytime if they want it, because they don't have it in the week. Anyway, I found out that my eldest is scared of spiders. My youngest has been finding spiders somehow on her iPad and showing it to her sister to make her scared before bed.
Oh, my word.
Sibling wars kicking off early doors.
Yeah. She's sharp, but evil, isn't she, that three-year-old?
Yeah, I think they both are to a point, but, you know, you need a bit of that in life.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it, Rob?
So this happens. I don't know if your daughter does this. My four-year-old nearly jumps out at me to scare me. like hides, and then when I go around the corner, like, if we're going to get in the car, she'll hide behind the car and then jump out. And obviously she isn't scary because she's four, and sometimes I don't even see her jump out. She tells me off for not being scared.
Yeah.
And I do sort of think that's more her problem for not being scary enough.
Yes.
You can't really tell someone off. And then sometimes I go, oh, like to pretend. And she goes, you're just pretending, and tells me off. And I think the blame really lies at the feet of the four-year-old. She's not up to the job.
Yeah. If she wants to scare you,
she's got to go about it in a different way.
Yeah, just like run into the road. That'd shit you up.
Exactly.
Like,
I'm not suggesting that. I mean, that's... I don't
suggest that to her.
But Uncle Josh has been on the phone. He's been up early. He's got some crazy ideas.
Yeah.
This is
if
your
you
new
want
one.
To scare me, play dead.
Yeah. Pretend to choke on your food. Stuff like that. That'll scare me. Jumping out from behind a car as a tiny little blonde-haired girl that's quite cute. No. But do stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Did I tell you the nursery school teacher pulled me up on me talking about Remembrance Sunday?
What?
So, you know, I said that she keeps talking about death because they got taught about Remembrance Sunday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She went, oh, yeah, sorry about that. I went, pardon? She went, I keep forgetting people listen to this.
Oh, God, yeah, me too.
And she went, sorry about the Remembrance Sunday thing. I was like, oh, what? She went, oh, yeah, because your daughter, you mentioned on the podcast that your daughter keeps talking about it and she's a bit obsessed by it. I was like, oh, yeah, I was so pathetic. You know, on here, I'm like, yeah, it's bang out of order. Why are they doing that? I was like, oh, yeah, it's okay, don't worry. It's just part of the curriculum, isn't it? And they've got none about it sometime. Yeah, I'm really sorry to mention it.
God.
I walked off. I thought, you maggot, Rob, you pathetic little lizard man. Shuffling off, tail between his legs. But she said she showed him a video of it with like a rabbit, and the rabbit was involved in it, which sounded more horrific, but I don't know what video that was.
What, the rabbit? The rabbit went over the top on 19, like
I think so. I don't know. It had myxomatosis anyway. It had nothing to live for.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
It's a Poppies on CBeebies. Children's Remembrance Sunday's 2 minute silence alternative. So it's a video of it's a CBeebies short of basically rabbits jumping around in a field. And then, oh no, this is awful.
Oh no.
There's a rabbit hiding under a helmet while there's bombs going off.
Oh my God.
It's horrific. That's worse. I'd rather watch Saving Private Ryan.
Remember who's listening, Rob.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, actually, it's really informative. It's great that they learn. You maggot, Rob. You little maggot. Poppies is a children's remembrance animation. Sees a great war experience by animal inhabitants of a World War I battlefield. I don't think you need the shell-shocked rabbit.
No.
She's only four. Just be silent for 2 minutes. Why are we doing this?
Rob,
you'll find out at one point.
Has your child ever been silent for 2 minutes?
Oh, God, there's a bird that's nearly getting shot by... No, my child's never been silent for 2 minutes. I once, when I was doing boxing pads, there's a snail that's scared. They're all hiding under an helmet. I remember I was doing boxing pads at a gym once, and I was doing it, and I was doing quite well. And as I was doing it, the combos were really hitting, it was really loud, and there was no noise apart from me. No one was, like, doing weights. No one was running. I was like, pow, 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 pow. And everyone was, like, sort of looking at me, and I was just like, am I fucking amazing at this? Have I stunned the gym into silence with my skills in boxing? No, it wasn't. It was Remembrance Sunday.
Oh, my God.
2 minute silence.
Oh, my God.
And I'm absolutely crunching out with a combo.
Oh, my God, Rob.
But my head went, God, I must be good at this. I've stopped everyone in their tracks. Then all the poppies come out and then the rabbit's all right. But there is a big bit in the middle that's quite bleak.
Do you want to say anything else to the nursery teacher?
I think they're doing a brilliant job, and thank you very much for casting her as Mary. They've obviously seen great potential in her acting ability.
Right, now, today's guest is Louis Theroux.
Yes, it's Louis Theroux.
I loved this. He Louis Theroux'd us at points, didn't he?
Yeah, he did try and Louis Theroux us a little bit. But then I think I laughed at an inappropriate point because he talked about having beef with other people in like the documentary-making world. It's really made me laugh because, like, how can you have beef with a documentary maker? You know, it's awkward. What are you going to do when you see each other? Just give each other a wry look, roll your eyes and walk off. I mean, it's not like Tupac, is it? And Biggie. I love Louis Theroux. I think he's amazing.
He's
and
brilliant.
I love chatting to him. He's great, isn't he?
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience. His book is out. He mentions it. Don't worry.
Of course he's got a book.
Of course
you know
he's got
score.
A bloody
you
book.
You know the score. You know the score now, people.
Exactly.
You are a big dog. You have to mention their book.
Let's be honest. If someone comes on here before Christmas, they haven't got a book, what's going on?
Also, our books are still available.
They're still available. They're still available. I'm to bloody hell. Eight-hour round trip because my book's still available. Anyway.
Yes.
Buy our books. Then buy Louis Theroux's book.
Yeah, in that order.
In that order. Buy all three. God. I'm still
and
tired,
And Paris
guys.
Furies, and Michael McIntyre's, and Jimmy Carr's. Who else is that? Izzy Surtee.
Izzy Surtee.
Fanny McGinnis.
Lucy Beaumont. Ellie Taylor.
And also, the Bible.
Yeah. Do you think in the last 2 months we've sold more than the Bible, Rob?
Are you suggesting that me and you combined are bigger than Jesus?
This is Louis Theroux. Enjoy yourselves. Hello, Louis Theroux. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Very good. Very good. Excited to have you on.
I'm ecstatic, Louis, mainly because we're massive fans, but also we need to, say thank you for not starting up your podcast again so that we can operate around the top three level of the podcast charts, because we all know when Louis Theroux comes out, you start to dominate it. So thanks for just letting a couple of young bucks have a go.
It's Peter Crouch. He was the other one that was always bobbing around at the top. It's quite an annoying thing, isn't it, when you see the same names popping up?
Yeah.
Currently, the podcast charts without you are like the Moscow Olympics when the USA didn't attend. It's like these gold medals are not quite worth having.
We all know. We all know deep down. And then we're basically on performance-enhancing drugs because we do two a week. So it's not really a fair chart, is it, when we do two a week, you know?
Well, good. Well done on doing your podcast, though, so successfully, though. I'll be happy to join the fray and give you a proper run for your money. So anytime in the next maybe couple of months, I might settle up, you know.
Really?
Can I ask a question about... We will get on to everything else, but I'm a fan of the podcast. And the episode where you interviewed Ruby Wax, I'd say, is possibly my favourite episode of a podcast I've ever listened to.
I've not heard that one.
Oh, it's incredible. And it's so honest and, well, I think awkward to an extent at the start when she's being honest about how she felt about you.
Oh, that's how, right. Well, I went in, I'd heard that she was...
Did you know this was going to happen?
Of course, yeah, because that was the sort of the premise of the conversation, was the idea that I'd heard that she had how do I put it? Like, she felt a profound rivalry bordering on ill will, actually way beyond that. She basically said on Adam Buxton's podcast, when she heard my name, it made her want to vomit because she felt that I'd done... as she put it, stolen her career, because she was in this sort of quirky documentary maker of offbeat subjects and then doing it very, and also celebrities, and doing it very successfully. And then around the same time I came along and did it on BBC Two, similar sorts of subjects. And she felt that I was basically copying her. And then when she, I don't know quite what happened, but anyway, she came to the end of the road at the BBC and felt that my success, such as it was, played a role in that.
So in her defence, though, Louis, you did do the pilot in an American accent, didn't you? That's something that we don't really talk about anymore, but that was a little bit, and then you changed it, didn't you, for the series?
And I did, and actually, the thing is, look, there's room for everyone, is the attitude I take. You know what I mean? Like, all the same, as we were joking about the podcast, at the same time, there's understandable little rival. When you see whippersnappers... I'd cast you two as whippersnappers. That's the bottom line, is you're younger than I am. Give me a chance to be a big dog, just for like a little while. Do you know what I mean? And then when younger people come along, and then you're like, oh. I felt a bit this way. This is going way back now. When it's very, very different. You're going to think like, but he's nothing like you. And you'd be right. But when Sacha Baron Cohen came along with Ali G, like I'd had about 2 years of building a little following on BBC Two with my documentaries, being a bit quirky, a bit silly, asking cheeky questions. And then suddenly everyone's saying, have you seen that Ali G? He's amazing. It's amazing. Ali G. And it was obviously, it was the hugest phenomenon. It was way beyond anything I've ever achieved before or since. And it was quite annoying, and I couldn't really justify it because he's obviously a comic character, a prankster. And as I say, very different, but it's hard not to be irked by that level of success. Anyway, I think I was Ali G to Ruby Wax. I was the younger person who she perceived as being more successful. So when we went on the podcast, I thought, let's get it out of the way. I'll ask that question near the top and we'll just deal with it. And it's always going to be awkward when you say to someone, I hear that when you hear my name, you want to throw up. You know, tell me more about that. But we kind of rode it and actually got to a place of sort of, but basically mutual understanding. And she seems a lovely person based on, you know, that chat that we had.
Well, I think that everyone gets that a little bit in whatever profession, isn't it? If you're doing a certain job for a bit and then someone else comes along and it's sort of it's more of an internal issue that's sort of exposed, and the person it's aimed towards is a bit irrelevant almost.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Because it's not, it's really about yourself. And she's got the wisdom to recognize that. She said, it's not about you, Louis. It was what you represented. I'm not doing the right accent. But she was talking about how it was something that she was sort of projecting onto me.
Yes.
Anyway, probably it was me as well, a bit.
No, but it must be annoying, though, if because you're really nice. You well, almost want so the person say. That comes through to be a prick, then it can be sort of justified.
Well, yeah, that's the you judo, know. Isn't it? Be nice. Sometimes you've got... What is it? You've got to be kind to be cruel. That's what it's by being the nice guy, you can actually confuse people even more. But I genuinely... When I heard that she had a beef with me way back, I heard about it first in the 90s. What did I feel? I suppose it's kind of like when someone has an issue with you, it's a little bit almost, it's like a compliment, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
In the rap world, I don't know how, you know, they call it haters. Not that Ruby was a hater, but in a way, it's like, you know, the idea is like there's haters out there, man, and that hate, it's like haters gonna hate. And then you basically feed off the hate, you know, you feed off the jealousy and the envy. I take like a lot of my life lessons from gangster rap, just to put that out there.
I want more of that. I mean, my career dream was for Stuart Lee to write a routine about me. Then you'd nailed it as a comedian. Yeah. If he wrote a routine slagging you off, you knew you'd smashed it.
Been there, done it.
You've been Stuart Lee.
I've been Stuart Lee.
Have you?
There we go. Yeah.
Have you really?
I have been Stuart Lee, but I don't know what he said. But I've been told I've been Stuart Lee.
Oh really?
And I know that I'm not strong enough to.
Oh, I love Stuart Lee. I think he's great, and I want to be...
got very real. This has got very real. Josh, do you literally... You actually mean that, don't you?
Yeah.
What would happen? Do you respect him too much, or you just... Anyone's bile would bother you in that way?
No, I... Do you know what? Oh, my God, I'm getting Louis Theroux. I can't believe it's happening.
This is great.
I don't think I respect him too much. I can honestly say that.
That's off the list. Is that a doctor going through issues?
Let's deal with that one first.
Yeah, let's get that crossed off.
I think he's an amazing stand-up. I just think it's like I don't read reviews because I think if I read a review of a tour that I was doing, even if I didn't agree with something about a bit, every time I then did that bit of stand-up, that would come into my head. Do you know what I mean? And I think if I don't know what I've got to gain by listening to myself being Stuart Lee.
Yeah. How do you know that you were Stuart Lee?
Because one of my friends has seen me be Stuart Lee live.
And he came back and joyfully said, oh, you'll never guess what.
You're not going to believe what.
Someone doesn't like you.
He texted me, Louis, the night before my wedding to say that he was watching Stuart Lee and Stuart Lee had done a routine about it. And I was like, I don't want that hanging over me.
Do you want me to find out what it is, Josh?
No,
and I can read it out to you on the podcast one episode, just as almost like as a therapy sort of thing.
I think
exposure.
That's the opposite of how therapy works.
No, not in my office. It's in my surgery, this is how it's done. Anyway,
the point is that anyone's opinion, it doesn't really, you know, you could say, I don't care what people think, but anyone's opinion can bother you. When I did my first series of Weird Weekends, there was a character in it who was a neo-Nazi who lived in a compound in far northern Idaho. He was borderline, well, I mean, he was politically deranged. And it was also quite comical because he was so camp. And he was called Jerry Grudel, and he was a big fan of Are You Being Served? And I thought he was such an amusing guy, this sort of neo-Nazi who was a fan of Are You Being Served, that when the shows went out, I thought it'd be really funny if I, as a bit, I'll send him all the first four episodes of Weird Weekends, and I'll get his thoughts on them, and that'll be quite funny. And I'll write a little article about it or something, you know, because he's a fan of British comedy, you know? He liked Benny Hill as well. So I sent them and I called him up and he said, I thought you did a pretty good job of making fools of people. And I was like, oh, that stings a bit. And then he went on to say, like, you gloried in it, ridiculing people, you gloried in it. And I was like, and the call suddenly went like, I suddenly thought, what's this weird feeling? Like, I'm getting upset by the fact that a neo-Nazi didn't like my TV programs. Like, that doesn't make any kind of sense. And yet there I was feeling that. Artistic personalities are sensitive, right?
Well, I don't think you ridiculed anyone. You're more like a GoPro at an all-you-can-eat buffet.
Yeah,
that's a do you know what I mean? Like, you know, that you're exposing what's going on, but they're the ones serving up the plate. You know what
there
I mean?
I like that. That's a nice way of putting it.
A GoPro buffet. Is that what you like?
Yeah, I'll put that on my resume.
Oh, right, we should.
If you're looking for a GoPro at a buffet, and who isn't?
This guy.
Let's talk to you about kids. Yeah. How you've got three kids?
Three boys, yeah.
Boys, and what are their ages?
15, 13, and one just turned 7.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the first question that comes to me when thinking about Louis through parenting is, you know, we've been here 10 minutes. I've opened up in a way I haven't opened up on this podcast before. Yeah. You've got that ability.
Thank you for that.
Do you use your documentary and interviewing skills in dialogue with your own children? And are you able to get them to open up to you in a way that I wouldn't be able to do with my children?
It would be nice if that were the case, wouldn't it? It would be nice if my professional powers, such as they are, were applicable in the domestic setting. If anything, I don't know why this is the case, but it's almost the reverse. And if I can segue kind of slightly brazenly into a plug for my book, Through the Keyhole, yeah. Only because it's very on point. That's the sort of the theme, really, is the idea that whatever sort of cool-headedness that I display when I'm on location doing stories, doing documentaries, somehow I completely lose when I'm sort of with my family. It's really odd. Yeah. Like,
I'm reading about your Christmas day in the book.
Yeah.
You're angry and you're
hungover.
Snappy.
Is the word hungover? Yeah, very hungover on Christmas Day. If you remember Christmas of 2020, it wasn't the best of Christmases. That was the one when Christmas was cancelled. Do you remember?
Yes, yeah, I do remember. Yes.
The rug was pulled from under us. We had a turkey that was designed to feed 30 people, and then sort of 2 days before Christmas Day, whenever it was like, well, we're not having Christmas this year. Sorry, guys. He sat there with an enormous turkey. And then the night before, you know, I know I'm going off topic, but, you know, so it was that feeling of like, well, I guess we've got really nothing much to do other than, speaking for myself, drink gallons of bourbon. And what was it? I was watching Die Hard 3 or 4. We were doing a sort of Die Hard marathon with the two older boys.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the point being that I think it's the feeling of, I think it's like I in a professional setting, I'm sort of focused. I know what I'm there to do, and I have a sort of almost clinical detachment from what's going on. But when you're with your family, it's almost the reverse. You've got so much skin in the game, right? You're the one trying to. When I'm on location, I'm sort of trying to wind people up. If anything, you know, you're trying to make something happen, right?
Yeah.
If you could catalyze an argument on a porn set, you know, or between a husband and wife who are swingers, that's golden, right? But and on the home front, theoretically, you're trying to make things run smoothly. But when the kids are telling you to naff off or whatever it is. And actually, you feel so much of your own vanity is invested in how they behave. And then if they insult you, the book is sort of unpacking, a large part of it is unpacking all of this. But that the weirdness of feeling sort of all the rage and upset that you get as a dad who is incapable of asserting the slightest bit of control. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
It feels like the most irrelevant person in the room at any particular time. And you think, how did it? I've got three BAFTAs. Like, surely I can get a phone out of the hand of a 12-year-old. Do you know what I mean? Like, this doesn't match up.
Sounds like the middle class version of what you call kids. I've got three BAFTAs. I've got three chavvies indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah, but have they watched your shows and stuff? The older ones.
The older ones, if they've watched them, well, okay, interestingly.
Yeah.
I've got some shows going out that are basically repackaged. There's shows that are sort of looking back at my old archive, you know, which a lot of that was going on when no one could make programs in lockdown.
Ruby Wax did some shows like that as well.
Ruby Wax did some. My ones were called Life on the Edge. Ruby Wax's were good as well.
I've just been sick. Here's some videos.
Yeah, exactly. The first time I vomited about Louis Theroux.
What's your view on Stacey Dooley? You call her. You got a bit.
I'm pro everyone. Stacey's terrific. Like Stacey Dooley and that whole genre of first person reportage. Stacey's tremendous. And actually, there's quite, you know, Mobeen Azar is also really good. Reggie Yates, who hasn't been.
Alice Levine. From,
Alice very,
Levine's,
very good. Yeah, I have the privilege of execing Alice's most recent project. Yeah, but the point was, the kids watching it. So I sat down with to watch my own program, which I'm, you know, that's, there's no shame in that, is there? So I'll watch it go out.
I think there's a bit, but not a lot.
Yeah. No, usually to 9 o'clock. See what I've had a couple of drinks.
It's a slight, like a sliver, like a sliver of a cake.
You know,
Joe,
it's that feeling about how does this look when it sits, when the continuity announcer goes, and now prepare for some strong language as we join Louis Theroux as he looks back. You know what I mean? And you're like, oh, yeah. This is, you know, you've seen it in the edit suite, but how does it feel, how does it groove into the continuity of the program? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, of course. Yeah.
The ident comes up and you're like, oh, this is exciting. And then I looked up and my 15-year-old was in the room and I thought, that's the first time I've seen him actually sit down and watch, well, begin to watch one of my programs. And then look, 2 minutes later, I saw he was on his phone.
Oh, no.
How did that feel?
It felt completely fine. It felt completely fine. Because actually, I don't expect them to see me as Louis Theroux documentary maker. Quite evidently, I'm Louis Theroux. I'm dad, right? I'm just dad. Yeah. And actually, I think if they ever want to watch them, you know, they'll watch them. And I'm happy to talk to them about that. But in the end, them respecting my professional role is the last thing I'm worried about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Literally.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
just to be able to, I don't know, like find out what they actually do at school. You know what I mean? To be able to, I don't know, like get them to engage in some domestic chores, like, or eat some vegetable. You know what I mean? Like, not to sound really prosaic. Like the idea, like, have you watched my program about Jimmy Savile? Did you think? Do you think I could have done more to unlock? I mean, that's not really. That's not what. No father should be.
I bet the 15-year-old want to watch the porn one. No. That's what they probably want to watch.
And actually, maybe they do watch some of them without me even being aware of it and prefer not. I think the whole idea of me having a profile as well is they're somewhat ambivalent about. For one thing, because as I'm out and about, we quite often get approached by people for selfies, which they find boring, you know, and even sometimes people go, okay, your dad, got to say, thanks for the selfie, look, got to say, your dad, he's a great man. Your dad, he's a really great man. No, I'm not saying this happens on a weekly basis, but, you know, once every 6 months or so, you know, someone will say something quite cringe like that. Yeah. I say it's cringe because they don't want to hear that. What are they going to go, oh, thanks. Yeah, I guess he is a great man. Do you know what I mean? And they think like, so why is he such an irrational guy or irrelevant? You know what I mean? Like,
why is he so drunk at Christmas crying at Die Hard?
Why is he forcing us to eat so much turkey? So that in the end, the idea of me having a profile is something they're not. And I think when I go to school, we were doing sixth form open days over the last week. And it's always like my oldest, who's 15, he says, can mum come, you know, instead of you? And I'm thinking, that's a bit rude. Thinking, why? Yeah. Because he knows that I'm so irrelevant, that I've got no decision making. You know what I mean? Like
really?
My input. So I said, why would you rather mum came? And he said, oh, just because, you know, people see you on TV. And I realized it was just that he just didn't want to
the
be
faff around it. Yeah.
He didn't want any of that murmuring.
Yeah. Cause at school, you just want to be left. You just want to get through it, don't you? You don't want any extra unnecessary attention about whether it's the coat you've got or what you do in that lesson and stuff like that. So it's just an immediate, like the light's on you straight away if you walk into the school.
And sure enough, when I went with him to one of them. And actually, I thought, most of the time, I thought, this is fine. I don't think there's any ripples of people sort of noticing. But then at the end, I saw a little clump of sixth formers. And you know how you get a free song when you feel like you've been clocked?
Yeah.
And they were looking up it's almost like they start going quiet, but buzzy, like, and they got the phones like, it is. No, it isn't. It is. I'm telling you, look, there it is. Yeah, documentaries, BBC Two. I'm telling you, And I was like, oh, here we go. And it was, it wasn't like, oh, they came over and asked for selfies, which would be fine anyway, but it was just that thing of, I can see why if you were 15 and just trying to get through the day, that would just be something you didn't.
I went to uni and a Jack Straw's daughter was in my halls, and she was defined by being Jack Straw's daughter.
Yeah,
which, you know, obviously at the time was a bigger deal than it is now.
Well, you've weirdly...
You wouldn't think that would be a huge cross to bear, would you?
No.
Well, you've got to remember, this was
it's not like being Michael Jackson's kid, is it? Do you know what I mean? It's like, what is there to...
Well, being called blankets hard enough. Well, never mind your dad being Michael Jackson.
Well, tell that to the people of Iraq, Louis, who were being invaded at the time.
So oh, no, your dad's invading Iraq. That's the last thing you need for double science.
Uni.
Right. Political.
Well, that's the thing, because you've got quite on paper, you've got a lot of young fans, Louis, haven't you, really? You're sort of a bit of, on paper, because your documentaries came out ages ago, you spread quite a lot.
Not all
a
of
lot
them,
of ages.
Some of them did. I have actually had some more recent ones.
No, but what I'm saying is, but on paper, you wouldn't expect an 18-year-old to be a big fan of a documentary about sort of crystal meth or whatever your
right,
new
exactly.
one is.
Or but indeed people... a programme that was made in the 90s
yeah.
about, you know, UFOs or the porn industry. Yeah. Like, because a lot of them, as you say, are old, and you know, 25 years I've been making programs or more, and so they have enjoyed some of them an unlikely afterlife, and I wish I could shed more light on why that would be the case, and I'm very grateful for that, for the fact that I've got some relevance.
Well, because you've like pop up on like TikTok and Instagram and Twitter, like your like memes and stuff of Louis Theroux reacting and No Context Louis Theroux and things like that. Yeah. So you've sort of really been adopted by that sort of Gen Z that never saw those documentaries firsthand, but now they've sort of discovered you and through that, and then now watching all your documentaries and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, Netflix is behind part of it, I think.
Really?
I think there was a time when they came on, when Netflix first appeared, what was that, sort of 2013 or thereabouts. And then it led to people were getting more onto Twitter. And I remember when I first noticed on Twitter that there was this sort of unlikely buzz around old programs. People kept saying, oh, Louis Theroux, My Money Don't Jiggle Jiggle, like references to a rap episode that I'd made sort of 20 years before. So I think that permanent present of Netflix, where anything that's on there is slightly timeless, you know, a lot of people, you know, Seinfeld programs, like, you know, again, old programs, but my kids love Friends, right?
Yeah.
And for them, that's not defined by being from the 90s, right? That's just a great show that sits up there on Netflix and that they endlessly binge.
And would you still watch Friends with them? And
you know what? 18 months of the pandemic, I didn't find I had an enormous amount of time to sit and watch old episodes of Friends. You know, I know a lot that people had different lockdown experiences, different pandemic experiences. And some people, especially people without kids, I think got quite bored and felt, oh, now I can actually arrange my tools in the tool shed or do these sort of jobs that I've never got around to do. I found that I never had time. We had, you know, if you had kids at home, and I don't know how old your kids are, but certainly the fact of us having a 5-year-old who turned 6, in fact, and then he turned 7 this year. It was that idea of like, it was triage. There was there was nothing. There was never a moment where I thought, oh, you know, I don't know what to do now because I've got so much free time. You know, you know what I mean?
Like, we had a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, so it was like, me and Lou go, oh, we need to sort that cupboard out in the kitchen. I was like, Lou, we never did that in the pandemic. Well, where the fuck are we going to find time to do it now?
Yeah. First day of the pandemic, I said to Rose, I'm going to do one cupboard a day through the pandemic. And then we'll have sorted the house out. Yeah. I did one cupboard on day one and that was it. Yeah. And that cupboard is now a fucking write-off.
Is it? Yeah, I did my wires behind the, you know, the wires behind the TV.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I was like, I'm going to tie them up and put little rubber bands around them. And then I'm going to get all the adapters and put them in an elegant little box. And I thought, well, this is going to be great. We're going to get, and then that was all done by the end of that day, basically. I think what was it? I think it was the degree of, I think it was the amount of time that was eaten up with the homeschooling. And then we started a company, my wife and I, so we were both full-time, you know, there was no case of being furloughed. We were attempting to get commissions for the company that we started. So there was an enormous amount of stress around that. So yeah, the question was about Friends. No, I don't, what I did, I loved it. Like in my dream scenario, I kick back with the kids and we play Fortnite together, right? Like I'm capable of enjoying, you know, video games. I grew up with Defender and Scramble. Those are probably before your time.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, the idea of, I don't seem to have, I think, like, oh, maybe when I'm retired, I'll be able to play video games because I don't have time now.
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself, I know you're big into hip hop as well. Yeah. Do you consider yourself kind of down with what they're into and stuff like that? Or would that be your worst nightmare to try and relate to them on that level?
I don't actively attempt to sort of, you know, be hip or like speak their language or, but I'm curious about what they like. And actually our 13-year-old, he's very strict about, well, how, I want to put this in the right way. Basically, he insists that we listen to Capital Extra whenever we drive anywhere, which is yeah. sort of dedicated to, almost exclusively to grime and drill music,
right?
Of a fairly high octane sort, and so it's a lot of Digger D and AJ Tracy and Dig Dat and H and I could go on.
Not the one.
I was
H&RD and all that and RD.
RD, yeah.
Oliver and Twist. But you must like this, right, Louis? Do you not?
Of course
like...
I do. And so, but there's occasionally I feel like, look, I wouldn't mind hearing a bit of Radio 4. There is a pandemic. Might be nice to know whether COVID's surging. You know what I mean? New variant, lockdown. You know, you think the war is, you know, the world's kind of teetering on the edge of apocalypse. But fine, let's listen to the new RD and Digger D. Why not? But it is, no, but you do, you know, and I enjoy the music. So by osmosis, I've become, yeah, a connoisseur of, a, you know, the modest sort of that, of whatever's in the kind of the grime and R&B charts. And then with regard to the gaming, I just see what they're into, but I don't get to play it.
Oh really? Can you play it though? If like you had the time,
probably
or you
not.
Completely, no,
probably you'd not. One of the chastening things. There's a game that that the little one was playing. It's called Duck Game, I think. And there's these ducks that run around. You're picking up guns and shooting each other. I think it's a PlayStation game. And I tried to play it. And it was, there's something quite, you know how with kids in general, especially small kids, it's like, obviously I've got to let him win some of the time. How, but can I win a bit? You know, that's the educational, right?
Yeah,
you can't let them win all the time.
No.
They'll never learn. They won't be socialized. And also, I quite want to win is the other part of it. But with the duck game, it was this weird thing of like, oh, I've got to that point of middle age where I'm actually worse than a 5-year-old at the game.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm trying to win and losing.
I've always played computer games and stuff, but I am drowning a little bit trying to keep up with the way they play. And also, like when they never used to do this multiplayer. Multiplayer when I was a kid was you had an attachment that you plugged into your machine, and everyone used to come to your house.
Yeah.
But now it's all online and everywhere. I find it so hard to keep up. And you see, like a 10-year-old will just destroy you on those games, and it's almost impossible to fully play with.
I want to play Strangers Across the World.
Yeah, it is fun.
Is it?
Yeah. But you're not playing strangers, you're playing your friends just in their house.
Oh, right,
yeah.
Okay.
You know, you
but
don't.
You're not playing like a
Josh is coming off more middle aged than I am.
I am.
Louis, it's an absolute nightmare.
Play strangers across
the world.
But I don't.
Can they see me through the screen? Where are they? Turn that camera off. Put a blanket over the webcam.
The television's talking to me. It's talking to me.
How do they know my name?
People do this, surely. I'm sure Alex Brooker from The Last Leg, he got suspended by FIFA for having a go at a child with his.
It's like Roblox. There is this strangers. I don't know if Roblox is the one where
that's big, isn't it?
You suspect that there's a no disrespect to the platform, but you suspect there's populations of paedophiles all playing it, and so they. And you think, oh, but maybe it is, I'm sure it's fine, but you just the anonymous hordes, with usernames. But you know, this is the world we live in.
You're now on the lookout for paedophiles at all times, Louis, after the Jimmy Savile pulled them all over your arse.
Aren't we all, though? Aren't we all? Isn't that the nature of... I mean, we're in the sense of, like, a world in which we're connected virtually to people, as you say, strangers across the world. Stranger danger. No, they invade our homes almost literally, like, via our devices, you know, TikTok. You know, when your kid comes to you and says... I've made a new friend on Roblox. Don't pretend that like some part of your mind is thinking like, hang on, red alert.
Nonsense alert, pedo. as a pedophile.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the thing. It's that loss of control where my mum still now always goes like, even though she's like, I'm 35, and she'll be like, she still wants me to have the same friends that I had when I was 15 because she knows their mums.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, it's just that extent. Like, well, can't go out with them because I sort of know them and I know their mum and I know they're nice and all that kind of stuff. That loss of control, I think, is the issue, isn't it, for parents when they're on the internet?
Well, exactly. I mean, and one of the, you know, this year that we've lived through, I mean, it accelerated a lot of the virtual aspects of the human experience, like the family life, because we couldn't mix socially. So grown-ups were on Zoom calls, either for work or doing Zoom quizzes or Zoom cocktail parties. And the kids were gaming. For a while, I thought, like, God, they're on their devices a lot. And then I realized that's the only interaction they have. Like, if you're going to chat in your lesson as you would normally at school, the homeschooling version is you've got your phone next to you and you're going like, this is boring, or I can't do this. Can you help me on the math stuff? Or gaming, and they, you know, they've got the headsets on. It felt, I don't know about you, but my experience of 2020 and 2021 wasn't just that we were going through a pandemic. It was almost like the future got accelerated.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was the weirdness of virality, not in the literal sense of, you know, germs or whatever they are, viruses, but in the sort of virtual sense of, wow, we're all kind of, you know, we've got this new app that took off called TikTok, which has the most aggressive data harvesting algorithm of any of the social media platforms, and they're profiling us. And, you know, I don't mean to sound like a techno kind of paranoid kind of mentalist, but I, you know, it's quite evidently our lives are being changed and we're experiencing the world in a different way. And there are concerns that go along with that. And we don't quite know what any of it means. And parts of it are positive because we can still communicate, and other parts of it feel less positive because we're aware that slightly sinister data corporations are getting an enormous amount of info on us.
Do you have rules with your kids on what they can do and can't do? Like,
well, it would be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, the rules are pretty relaxed in our house. I mean, and actually we've tried to pull it back a bit, but it was a bit like, well, we're in the middle of a kind of world altering pandemic.
Yeah.
So the fact that they're on their phones a lot, or that, you know, the little guy, the 5-year-old's up and goes straight to his iPad. Like, in the normal world, I'd be like, no iPad until after breakfast. Like slightly limp rules like that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? You know, like, if you want to watch YouTube, you've got to at least put some socks on. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. You can't have that until they've had jam on toast.
Yeah, meaning, kind of meaning. Like, why do you have to wear socks to watch YouTube? This doesn't make any sense. You know, some big leaf that some authority has maintained.
Yeah.
But actually, the rules are pretty much just designed to maintain some illusion of control. But at the end of the day, we don't have many rules. Not really. Yeah. Like, we have screens during the week. You know, some families, like, we don't have screens during there. And even screens, I mean, I'm sort of, come on, why don't you watch a bit of TV? Like, put the iPhone down and watch a bit. You know, like in my day, it was like, put the switch the TV off and read a book. Now watching the TV feels like the educational option. You know, a DVD. Why don't you watch a DVD?
Like,
come on. Yeah, there's a point in the evening where they're supposed to stop gaming, and I know I'm
telling. What time's that?
It's about 11 o'clock. the little one goes up about 8 o'clock. Yeah. I know. Yeah. I've got it's
11 o'clock.
Yeah, 11 p.m. 11 that doesn't p.m. sound good, does it?
There'll be the pedo going, come on, kids, I've got work in the morning. Give me a chance. I'm knackered here.
That's so grim. But the point being, as long as they've done their homework and as long as they are, you know, basically doing so, we have dinner together. We sit down and have a meal together. You know, they clear their plates. Those are a few of the benchmarks. Do you know what I mean? In terms of some level of civility that we try and maintain.
I do find, though, with the gaming there, because I experienced when I played Warzone, which is basically you log onto this game and it's sort of like an army game, but you text your friends and go, oh, go on at 8, and then you're playing the game, but really, I'm just enjoying the chat and my friends. So I think gaming used to be like, oh, it's not very sociable, but actually it's more sociable than them just sitting on the sofa on their
phone.
That's
the point. Yeah,
they're sat there chatting, but because they're in front of a screen on a computer, it's the same as when I used to go down to the local park and sit in a circle of mates chatting shit. bit, and then someone would get a bottle of cider or whatever it was that they did run in that park. But you are essentially socialising. But because I think the older generation, like, you know, you're not, they're playing a game, but you're not. You are chatting with friends. It's just like I say, it's like in the middle of this mad revolution.
That's better for them than when I used to sit alone and play Championship Manager for 12 hours on my own in my bedroom.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. But what a 12 hours that would be.
Right.
Why no, but I thank you for that, Rob. I think that's the whole point, isn't it? It's a different paradigm. It's not just watching Open University for 3 hours as I did of a morning, you know, when I was woken up and my parents were still asleep and I had nothing to do. It's not mind-numbing and solipsistic. Yeah. It's actually, as you say, it's social and they're interactive, and they're like, they make appointments with their friends. And oftentimes I realize when I say, like, right, time to get off, and they're really upset, it's because they've made an appointment with someone who's expecting them to turn up. And so I'm like, why is he, there's so much rage, like, come on. And you try and lay the law down. And actually, what you don't appreciate is there's much more going on to do with the peer group and what they're up to. My sort of nuclear option, which I have only done once, I think, because some of their gaming they do, and also they only go on at one at a time. So we got one machine, like they're like, well, we want to get two PlayStations. I said, no, there's a hard no on that, because that's one of the few ways we can. So they figure out how to take turns, and then. And as a result, there has to be some element of restraint, because they can't both be on it at the same time. But when
you 2 more years max before you get another one.
Yeah, maybe we'll see. We'll all be in the metaverse. We'll have about 2 more years. Can you imagine? We'll be just playing with chips in our brains.
Oh God!
We'll have like, Dad, I want to download the PlayStation chip into my neurocircuits, right? I want to get a new neurocircuit. Anyway, that's what Elon Musk is saying is going to happen. Anyway, the point is, one of them was being a little bit cheeky, and he went off in a strop, and I said, no, you're not going back on. The gaming that they do, there's a studio at the bottom of the garden that we got built that was supposed to be for me and my wife to work in, and then became the gaming zone. Anyway, what I discovered was one day, with a delight, I looked at the fuse box and it said garden studio on one of the switches, and I realized that I had control over all the electrics. And I said, you're coming back, young man. You're not doing anything. And he said, stop me, or something like that. And I went back and I said to Nancy, my wife, I said, you know, there's a switch I can turn off. And she said, don't do it. So give him a chance. I said, give him a warning. So I went down and said, you're going to come off there. I'm telling you. And he's like, you know, whatever. He refused. And so on one occasion, I flipped the switch. And it was nothing. I can't imagine anything more satisfying. So seeing him down there on his little joystick through the French windows, and then suddenly it went dark, and I just saw a little silhouette of someone trying to figure out like the incomprehension, and then his screen had gone. If I felt like Sauron, do you know what I mean? Sort of being able to just, I can just eliminate people just with a flick of a switch. Anyway, and after that, they knew that I had the power, so I haven't had to do it again.
What was his reaction to that? Was he angry, or was he quite actually respecting the hustle of you finding the fuse switch? Because that, you've got a lot, when you're annoyed, but you've got good, to be fair.
Yeah, it was rage and respect. There was some part of it was like, fine. It was like a little bit, okay, I get that, checkmate.
Amazing. Oh, that was a bit like mums in the 90s could turn the internet off by picking up the landline.
That's very true, isn't it?
Just
I've forgotten
bang.
About that.
They were more powerful than Bezos in about 96, weren't they, mums? 90s mums.
That's a good throwback. That was like the feeling when you went to make a phone call and then you realize you heard. And you realize, I've just interrupted my dad's internet. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You put it quickly down. You thought, maybe no one will notice.
In our house as well, I swear, if you picked up the phone but then you was upstairs, you could listen to the conversation.
Yeah, you could. Yeah. So you could. And then your mum would shout you when your friend called, and you'd get it on the upstairs phone, and then you'd wait and you'd go, can you put down the downstairs phone? But like, you didn't want to listen in on your phone conversations.
We were saying that Stuart, that was the badge of honour, and that was you knew you'd made it when you were a Stuart Lee. But then I was thinking about, did Joe Pasquale, he did quite a long routine. Do you remember about Joe Pasquale? I don't know that was enormously helpful to Joe Pasquale.
No, but I think it was a sign that he'd become a household name and was successful in his field, you know?
What I'm worried I'm going to find out about it is that it's just an aside. He just made a joke as an aside one night, and so I haven't even qualified. I've got the kind
it's
of...
It's bigger
slap.
In your head, Josh.
But he's actually, I haven't made it into a routine.
In your head, what's he having a pop at you for?
Oh, that's a good question, isn't it? Because that's saying, what are your biggest dislikes about your own persona and professional image? Yeah?
Well, it might not be dislikes, because it might be, you know, what's your perception of the part of your brand Widdicombe that he would have an issue with? Because it might be something you're fine with, that you're, for the sake of argument, you know, family friendly, or I don't know, insufficiently left
wing. Or it might be observations. Because that's an easy Stuart Lee thing, because he's done that before about people observing stuff.
I think it would be mainstream and mundane.
Or that you're not disabled and you're on the last leg.
That's a good one.
If you were to write...
It's to be disabled.
Well, people think Josh is disabled.
It'd be like, you know the guy, the one that hangs around with the two disabled guys. You know that guy.
That guy.
He's got that annoying voice that goes like this, that guy.
Everyone's got the thing that they think other people know about them, that they're worried. You know, like if it was Jimmy Carr, it might be taxes, right?
Yes.
It might be a Jimmy Savile reference. Do you have anything like that where,
I don't think, not to my knowledge.
No, you're clean cut, aren't you, Josh?
That's worse in a way, because whatever it is hasn't come out yet.
I keep stroking his chin, all panicked. Look at this, he's great through work.
He looks so worried right now.
Always looks panicked, doesn't he?
He's jiggling in his chair.
I'm not jiggling in my chair.
Yeah, like rubbing his hands together, leaning back. Look at this. You'd have a field day on Big Brother's Little Brother. All these tells. They'll get the body language expert on. You see Josh there, he strokes his chin, lean back.
I don't know what to do with my hands now. I want to touch my face, but I'm not allowed to.
What are you going to do? Look, he don't know what the...
Do you worry about the way people perceive you?
Of course. I mean, the other one, I did an interview for the podcast about John Ronson. And by the way, both of these are referenced in my book. I talk about... It's not just family life. I talk about starting my podcast Grounded in my book, Through the Keyhole, because it was one of the ways I stayed busy during lockdown. I sort of reinvented myself as a podcaster.
You and John Ronson have had this kind of relationship where there's...
Well, is there beef? You got beef with Ronson?
Well, it was a very Biggie and Tupac kind of situation.
Oh, I love it. I love a posh boy beef. Was it a wry smile? Roll of the eyes?
I wanted to gat him.
I've heard it's Suge Knight that set you against each other, actually. It wasn't actually either of your fault. It was Suge Knight who was the real problem, right?
He was stirring us up. I wonder who the Suge Knight is in this scenario.
So what happened? Because I don't know anything about anything about this. What's the beef?
If you know, he's a terrific writer who wrote The Psychopath Test, and then going back to the early 90s, before I was ever on TV, he had a series called The Ronson Mission. Yep. And he was a columnist for Time Out, and he's a brilliant comic journalist who would write about quirky subjects like sort of sex workers or you know, swingers, religious cults, so the sorts of terrain that I later was known for covering. But his series, The Ronson Mission, was a great series, but it wasn't especially widely viewed. And when I popped up, I think he did feel because he said that, well, the quote he gave, he said, "I felt a bit like the Pixies must have felt after Nirvana came along," which I think is an interesting musical reference, because it's actually not insulting to me.
There's a bit in his book, Them. I don't know if you've read his book.
I've read that. I've read all John's books.
Yeah, and so he's being followed in a car outside the Bilderberg group, and he calls the police to say, "I'm being followed." And they say, "What do you do?" And he says, "I'm a journalist. I write these stories." And this is a point he's being followed, and the police say, and he says, "I write stories about, like, the kind of things he does." And the police say, "Oh, like Louis Theroux."
Yeah. Yeah.
Love it. This is great. Yes.
And he's like, "Well, no, I was originally the one that did it."
Ruby Wax comes out the passenger seat. "Well, actually, I think you'll find I've done interviews as well." Fucking hell. It's like no one's ever... It's like this rivalry. It's like no one's ever asked anyone anything about themselves before on telly.
Yeah.
Parkinson pops up. "Well, actually, you used to do it, sat down." So,
Did you ever end up... Because you're good friends now, right?
Yeah. We were always... I had met him at that point. And it was more or less through the grapevine, through mutual friends, that I heard, "Oh, John's, you know, he's got... You know, he's having a bit of angst over the fact that you've kind of... You're doing a more successful version of what he was doing."
It's quality, guys.
And I was such a big fan of John that I suppose I thought... What did I think? I thought, well, that's a big compliment. Like the idea that, you know, he was one of the, when I was coming up, when I saw the Ronson mission, he was one of those people that thought, oh, I really love that. I wonder if I should write him a letter and let him know. I never did. You know, like very, you know,
yeah.
It doesn't often have anything. I like that so much. I'm so intrigued by that. I find that so different. I might drop that person a line. Nah, maybe not. But anyway, I thought about it. And so when I heard that, he'd really enjoyed the series to the point of having a kind of existential crisis over it. I thought, well, that's, you know, that's about the highest compliment, you know, I've caused him a mini breakdown.
That's what you want.
There's no higher compliment than that, really.
Yeah.
And then later we met and we talked about it. And then he did more, his writing, you know, he's been into ever upward gradient of success with his writing. He moved to America. And so when I interviewed him for the podcast, and actually, I, you know, his books are so terrific. And then when I would read them, I'd get a pang of sort of professional envy, feeling like, wow, he's such a terrific writer. And then he sells books by the shed load. Yeah. And then he's in America and America's buying all his books. And suddenly it felt a bit like role reversal. Like I was like, yeah. Oh, Ronson, like he's really successful in America, you know, where I've got, you know, I guess a pleasingly kind of selective appreciation among my fan base. Like I don't, no one in America really knows who I am. And so when we talked, I said to John, he said, like, you know, I'm very relaxed now about you. You know, it was really painful. I'm trying not to do an offensive John Ronson impression. Yeah.
Oh, you're doing pretty bad job of that, because I think...
he said, back in the day, like, I used to find it painful that, you know, but now I'm really relaxed. And I was basically saying, like, yeah, I find it a bit more painful now, John, to be honest.
It's nice to be honest about it with each other, though, because that's when, if you don't talk about it, I think that's a bit of a hangover from, like, you know, 25 years ago when you started doing all these shows, you got on the radio or on BBC and one person sort of did it. So it was Ruby Wackschmidt, then you, and then Ronson didn't get the call. And then it was like, well, what's my career? It's all over like now. I can't, that's been taken. But, and I think Mock the Week was like that with comedians. But now there's so many avenues. You can do podcasts, you can do YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, and ways to get an audience and be found and stuff, that I think now there's a lot less of that rivalry amongst our generation coming through, I think, on telly. Josh, do you think that's, that's true?
Do you know what always happens, and I'm sure, is you'll be in an interview and someone will go, God, but it's really horrible, you and your peers, you know, you must all hate each other and you're jumping all over each other on, not like on each other's lines on Mock the Week and stuff. And I think, like, all of our generation, there's something weirdly, we're all much more matey than I think people would ever like to think, in a way. Do you know what I mean? There's very little kind of beef.
But all these things can also coexist is the other thing. Mm. Yeah. You can love someone and also, you know, there's, you know, if I have one sort of thing that's almost, I feel, is a misapprehension about the nature of human psychology, it's the idea that our motivations and our feelings are also unitary. Like, oh, you feel either profound love or you feel profound hate, and there's nothing intermixed or alloyed about it.
And, totally.
And actually, to this day, like, there's people who I care very much about who at the same time, if I saw them get an incredibly good review that said, actually, you know, this person's a genius and there's no one alive today is going to achieve any. There's some little part of me that would feel a pang, you know?
Oh, and, totally. I love James Acaster. He's one of my oldest friends. But if I see another suggested Instagram of a fucking James Acaster meme, I would be delighted, because it's the bane of my life.
Yeah.
That's the irony is, he hates it as well.
He quit Instagram. He doesn't even have to see a meme. So we don't need to put these up. He's not even here anymore.
What about you and Rob? Oh. Josh and Rob, you work together, right? Sometimes it's the ones that you are actually married to professionally that you feel like this odd little, well, why did you get the call and I didn't? Have you ever talked about that?
I don't think so, really. Me and Josh haven't experienced that. But with Romesh and stuff, well, he was at the BAFTAs and we were nominated for a show together, and he was nominated for Ranga Nation in the same category, and then he was also nominated for Best Entertainment Performance, like the sort of one with, it was like with Bradley Walsh and a few Adam Hills and a few other people, Claudia Winkleman and stuff like that. And I was sat next to him and I was like, and he'd won it for best performance. And I was like, oh, I wonder how I'm going to feel. Because you never know how you feel.
Yeah.
But I was so relieved that I was just like so excited for him and so happy. And then he came and sat back down again. And then the next award, and the next ball come up. And it was for that one for us and the one him. And I went, at one point here, he could win best performance without me and then win without me again in an award up against it. I went, this should be nightmare fuel. But I was like, this on paper is like an anxiety dream. Yeah. But I sat there and then I think Big Nasty won anyway. But I genuinely was like, that was one of my favourite nights in my career, that I could be at an award thing like that and be so happy for a mate and not really be bothered. Where
that's
other people
a nice
there,
feeling. Yeah.
And that honestly was almost better feeling actually than winning it, because it was like, you have the still sort of like, how you feel if that happens, but I was just generally so buzzing for him. And you can see the reaction of it. It was a genuine like, oh yeah, fucking well done, mate. Because, you know, it's nice all those awards and things like that, but ultimately it don't really matter.
No, and you're like, maybe I'm a nice person, you know?
Yeah, like, well, exactly.
Do you know what? When I was, because I don't like going to those things. I find them really oppressive. And it's why I used to hate Edinburgh, because it makes you in competition with people that you don't want to be in competition with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We weren't nominated this year for Last Leg for the first time in 5 years.
Yeah.
We've never won. But
he loves it of all, Josh.
Do you know what? I was so relieved when we weren't nominated, because I thought I don't have to go through that experience of going again.
Well, yeah, but then maybe that experience shouldn't matter so much.
No, I know, but that's...
Well, because for me, I love doing Rob and Romesh, right? I love doing Rob and Romesh. I get to spend time with my mate all day and making a show I really, really love. If we win that BAFTA, that's not going to make my day-to-day enjoyment of that show better or worse. So if day-to-day I'm enjoying the show, that's the main thing. All the other stuff's a bit irrelevant, really. Would you take winning a BAFTA every year but hating filming the show? No, that's my worst nightmare.
Oh, yeah, totally.
To be trapped in that, something that's really successful that you hate, I might as well just stayed working in my old jobs, if that's the case. But you can see how it traps people.
That's the thing, though, because I'm a bit older, and actually, you, in a weird way, you find when you get older, you care slightly more. And I don't know why that would be the case.
Really?
Yeah, that's my experience.
So I think I care much less. Like, I cared about stuff when I was... Like in Edinburgh, it really destroyed me. Like it became like that first year when you could be nominated for newcomer. It was like a horrible thing for the whole month. That Edinburgh, my first Edinburgh, I got a spot on the end of my nose on the first day that was so bad.
It started getting reviewed itself, didn't it?
It got nominated without me. It was so bad. I had to get makeup put on it by the person who was producing the show every day. And the spot stayed for the whole of Edinburgh and then went 24 hours after Edinburgh.
So really?
Like, yeah. But now I really don't feel... I feel like John Ronson when he's being interviewed by you, Louis. I feel much more laid back about the whole thing.
Well, that's where you want to be, really, isn't it? Mm.
So why do you think you care more now, Louis? Because on paper, I don't think there's anything else you can really achieve. Like you look like an all-round success in the traditional sense.
I think what happened was I won two BAFTAs when I was quite young. And the first one, this is going back 20 years, like 2000, 2001, something like that. And the second one, I was in a weird place at the time, so I just felt very blank about it. And then over the next sort of 15 years, 20 years, I made some amazing programs. I mean, obviously I'm biased, but I went programs in San Quentin Prison and the Westboro Baptist Church, and then year on year, I might have got nominated a few times, but never won. And I think what happened was when I finally won another one, I sort of thought, actually, I deserve this. And that sounds dreadful, but the first two, I thought like, well, this is a crapshoot. Who cares? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's a meaningless bauble, more or less. But then by the time, when 20 years go by and you've made a ton of programs, I sort of thought, well, why not? Actually, this isn't going to happen. May never happen again. It hasn't happened for 20 years. I almost tried to make a conscious decision to make it mean something, if it's arbitrary, which to a great extent those things are, why not allow it to count for something?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I definitely think it shouldn't mean nothing. It's a nice thing to win. It's a pat on the back. That's nice. And it helps in your career and getting commissions and that kind of stuff. So you have to accept that it is worth something.
That's the other part of it. You know, here's the other thing. Is what you realise is it means something to other people.
Yes.
And it's odd, isn't it? I don't quite know what to make of this, but it's that feeling of when you realize something means something. It's like the first time you realize people care about ratings when you're in TV. Like it's an odd thing. The first time you have a TV show and people are going like, second one built, second one was up to 1.5. And you're like, what does that mean? That's good. You're growing. And then the third one is up to 3 million. And that's really good. Is it? Yeah. Yeah. And then the one day when they come in, happened on my second series where they're like, yeah. And you're like, what? What is it? Yeah. Well, no, it doesn't matter. You're like, well, no, what is it? What? What? Well, the ratings are in. Yeah, and? 1.2. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Yeah, it is. Not really. It's not brilliant. And then you're like, oh, my God. And then you're being, it's encoded in you from there on, like, yeah. Must care about ratings. And then you find yourself checking them. And then it becomes almost a mini obsession because you realize this is more than reviews, more than anecdotal feedback. This is the barometer by which everything is judged. And the same thing with the BAFTAs is he's like, oh, sorry about the BAFTA.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, it's fine. You know, Ronson deserved it or whatever. Ruby Wax, her title was her year. But actually, and then the fifth person is like, oh, it's too bad about the BAFTA. And you're like, yeah, you start to feel it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I
don't
know
how you have to ignore it.
With you and Romesh, we're like, oh, shame about Romesh. Oh, you must feel really shitty about that. And you're like, no, I'm fine. And then they keep saying, I used to like, this is a bit of a jump, but I used to live in Harlesden and I loved it. And, you know, we had a great big house and I didn't realize that it had a bit of a sort of a connotation of being sort of a bit rough and ready. And then I found myself at parties. They said, where do you live? And I said, I live in Harlesden. And then their face would like fall, like, oh, God. Oh, I'm sorry. Like I just said, my grand's got cancer or something. Like, oh dear, sorry about that. And you find yourself affected. Like you find other people's value judgments somehow are contagious, right?
Yeah,
as much as you might want to resist it.
You have to work on a vaccine internally, don't you, to sort of be oblivious.
There we go. You need that. Maybe that's the self-help book we need to write.
Well, the thing I can say this about the BAFTAs, next time you're worried about the BAFTAs, just remember they gave Rolf Harris one. So, you know, do you really want to be part of that, alumni?
Well, exactly.
Probably more than one. Did he only get one?
I don't know. I've definitely seen a photo of him holding
what
a BAFTA
did he
up.
Win a BAFTA for? Animal Hospital?
Oh, they gave him the fellowship. They've stripped him.
Oh, is that what he got, a BAFTA fellowship? Well, Jimmy Savile got a knighthood, right?
Yeah, he did.
God. Have they stripped him of that?
Well,
I don't know if you can strip someone who's already died of a knighthood, can you? I don't know.
They'll find the grave and do the little Lord thing, but in reverse. Just to take it back. Left to right instead of right to left. Oh, no wood.
How often do you think about Jimmy Savile? Do you think about him daily?
Do you know what? I've kept a diary of the last 18 months and it's in book form.
Yeah.
Called Through the Keyhole, Diaries of a Grounded Documentary
How can I get
Maker.
Hold of it?
You can buy it off Amazon. It's also there's an audio book.
Where is it in the charts? How many are sold? How are you feeling about
somewhere
that?
It's in top five on Audible.
How are you feeling about that? Someone above you, hey? How's that getting you read?
And I mention it because Jimmy Savile is in it. You get a sense of the extent to which it comes up, which is to say not daily. It's not at the forefront of my mind, but it's not uncommon if I'm... So, for example, if I'm being interviewed for a new TV series... It will almost always get mentioned, and it will be, was Jimmy Savile your biggest failure? That was one question I was asked.
Oh,
and then there's a story in the book where I talk about going through the park on a walk, on a ramble with the kids and my wife, and we, and a woman says, I have to tell you, you're absolutely fantastic. Keep doing what you do. You are wonderful. And she wanders off, and I say to my wife, isn't that nice? Like, that's the great thing. Everyone should have that. You know, imagine if all people had random strangers coming up and saying, you are wonderful. The place would be so full of joy. So then we walk a bit further down the park, and there's a guy sitting on a bench with an old bicycle, and he looks over. He says, how about Jimmy then? And I think, keep walking. And I go, all right, yep. And I keep walking. He goes like, he's going to haunt you.
Oh, God.
And then I said to my wife, well, so it kind of balances out. You're wonderful, but you'll be haunted by Jimmy Savile.
Yeah. Well, I think what's more annoying is that people see you as the only person that ever interviewed him, gave him a job or knew about what he was doing. Yeah. Well, you didn't know what he was doing, but the only person that ever met him in his whole career, which is very unfair just because you're a victim of your own success of that big show. But yeah, no, you shouldn't. Yeah. That shouldn't haunt you. Should he completely forget about that?
Thank you for that.
One final question. We've gone off a bit of off topic with parenting, but I think it's been a brilliant episode, so that's fine. The question is there one thing your partner does parenting that annoys you a bit?
Many. Okay. But since we're in the season of holiday goodwill, one of the things she does is she buys the kids advent calendars. I'm fine with that.
Yep.
Advent calendars with chocolates in them. And then for the whole of December, at least till the Christmas day, it's considered acceptable to have chocolates at breakfast. And, yeah. And for me, I'm old fashioned that way. Like, I just sort of think, you know, I love chocolate, but you don't have chocolate at breakfast and it feels like all bets are off. Suddenly we're in savagery. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just going to have chocolates. Meals don't matter. Who, you know, forget cereal. So I don't make a big thing out of it, but I kind of exude a sort of wary sense of judgment when those advent calendars come out.
Can I suggest other advent calendars you can get? They do Playmobil ones and Lego ones. Get a little things to build and then they do that in the morning rather than they're quite good.
Well, just a lovely picture of a shepherd.
Used to be excited
so old,
about
Josh.
The door, you know, the cardboard door is slightly bigger. Oh, the picture's bigger on this one. I would get a thrill out of opening the little right out of the little door and seeing a it's a robin.
Yeah, you can't have that. That was before Google image search.
Are people too busy playing computer games against strangers to enjoy a robin?
Strangers across the world with the TV watching me. I just want a little picture of a reef and then I'll walk to school.
What
my satchel.
Is wrong with a picture of a donkey with a pregnant woman on it? Really? Is there something wrong with that?
Thank you very much, Louis.
The book, Louis Theroux the Keyhole. Loved it.
Theroux the Keyhole. We've plugged that plenty. Good luck with everything. Good luck in the podcast charts. Keep doing what you do.
Cheers, mate. Bye. Louis Theroux.
Love that.
I love Louis Theroux.
I just listen to him forever.
He's great, isn't he?
And what you don't get when you watch his documentaries, obviously, is how self-analytical he is. Do you know what I mean? He really beats himself up, but he really thinks about what he's thinking and what he's going through and what his emotions are and stuff like that. Like, you talk to him about his family and he's properly thinking about his emotional responses to it and stuff. He's he's very self-analytical in a way that makes you feel better about your own family torment, should we say.
Well, yeah. So are you saying, though, that it makes you feel better about the way you torment yourself about your family because someone you respect does it? Or are you saying that's...
Yes, I'm saying that completely.
Yeah, and rather than that's what you should be doing. My argument would be you shouldn't need to torment yourself that much.
Yeah, but...
He's Louis Theroux and it's fine. You know,
if I'm honest with you, Rob... Yeah. That isn't an option for me. I'm going to torment myself, so I might have got to find ways around it. That I can't solve that. That's happening.
My argument was it's a shame that someone so intelligent does torment himself that much because he's doing such a good job. And he's both of you. However, you're saying, actually, it's fine to self-torment because someone I respect does.
Do you know what, Rob? You've got to fight the battles you're given. And I know what I can change. I can't change the fact that every day I torment myself from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep.
And when you're crying on your exercise bike having a panic attack, you're thinking, Louis Theroux probably does this, so it's
exactly,
fine.
Exactly, okay. So that's good.
If it helps, it helps.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? But no, I enjoyed that. We went off piste a little bit, but I think it was really interesting. So thank you for listening. That was Louis Theroux. We told you we'd get big dogs leading up to Christmas.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even promoting anything.
Joshua. They've all got books, haven't they? We've done.
Has Louis Theroux got a book out? He didn't mention it.
How well have we done to bring a book out in such a crowded market, Josh? Well done to you. And
thank you
to our listeners. Because let's be honest, and these are the hardcore now that they've listened to the end of this because it's probably a long episode. Thank you so much for buying the book. It's amazing.
Yeah,
thank you so much. But also, I would say as well that I have looked at the figures and how many people listen to this on a weekly basis compared to the book sales, and I would say probably about 10% of you bought the book. So well done to you. But the other 90%, have a fucking look in the mirror, put your hand in your pocket and buy our fucking books. Forget Louis Theroux. Buy our fucking books, right?
It's Christmas.
It's Christmas.
Come
buy
on.
It for someone, okay?
Come on.
Fucking content. No, I'm only joking. Have a good
for Stuart Lee.
All right, we'll see you on Tuesday.